This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm quite excited today because we are talking about a really interesting book. I'll just get straight into, I guess, the title and the content. It is called State Building as Lawfare: Custom Sharia and State Law in Postwar Chechnya, published by Cambridge University Press, which addresses two absolutely fascinating and interrelated puzzles. Why do local rulers tolerate and even promote non-state legal systems at the expense of state law? And why do some members of repressed ethnic minorities choose to resolve their everyday disputes by using state legal systems instead of the existing, the tolerated non-state alternatives? In the context of a lot of countries, these questions are really interesting, and especially perhaps in the context of Chechnya. So I'm very pleased to welcome the author of the book, Dr. Yegor Lazarev, to the podcast to tell us all about it. Yegor, thank you so much for being with us.
Miranda, thank you so much for having me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I'm a political scientist. I teach now at Yale University. And this book is derived from my doctoral dissertation that I defended a few years ago at Columbia University. So I've been working on these issues of law and politics in the North Caucasus for the last, 10, 15 years. So it's been a very kind of a big part of my life. And I started conducting fieldwork in the North Caucasus when I was still an undergrad student in Russia. So I was going back and forth between St. Petersburg, that's where I'm from, and Dagestan, Chechnya, Ossetia, so different parts of this very interesting region. And ultimately decided to write my dissertation on the politics of legal pluralism, so the coexistence of state law, customary law, and Sharia. I was really fascinated by when I started observing the processes related to legal pluralism, how elders and religious authorities adjudicate disputes in the shadow of the state. So this really became the motivation to figure out how the society functions when there are multiple alternative rules of the game being there at once. And so this was kind of the main motivation for writing about this book.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. As I said, the puzzles are absolutely fascinating. Before we get into, though, the answers to them, staying, I suppose, at the kind of big picture level, can you make sure that we're all on the same page? What do you mean by lawfare? And how does this help us better understand processes of state building?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very important question, mostly because I use the concept of lawfare in rather non-conventional ways. So kind of usually we think of lawfare and use it in kind of national security or security studies framework as a use of law as a weapon of war. And this is not how I use it at all. I use an anthropological notion of lawfare, which basically means the use of law and non-state legal systems to achieve political, social, economic goals. So it's a deliberately broad concept. And, you know, usually in social sciences, we look for concept that would be very narrow and capture a very particular element of social reality. And I was actually looking for something else. I was looking for a broad concept that would allow me to capture at the same time the behavior of politicians and their strategies of engagement with state and non-state legal systems, and also individual choices, choices of ordinary people when they face a dispute, how to solve an particular dispute based on state and non-state legal systems. So I was trying to cover politicians and individuals, kind of very different levels and different type of strategies. And for me, this broad concept of lawfare, again, as a use of non-state and state legal systems for political goals was very helpful.
Hmm. All right. That's, I think, a very helpful clarification to start with. Working at the level of politicians, I suppose, first, there's obviously some kind of questions that politicians have to deal with, leaders have to deal with, in terms of legal pluralism, even if it's sort of existing, whether it's out of a state of conflict or for whatever other reason, they still have to kind of decide, like, well, is this okay? Are we going to allow this? Are we going to try and stop it? Are we going to try and work with it? What sorts of options do leaders have when they're in a situation where there is legal pluralism going on? And what sort of factors determine what approach they take towards this reality?
In my thinking, you know, I was trying, when I was writing about this, I said, like, you know, imagine yourself being a political leader in a nation or a region that goes through kind of the process of decolonization. For example, you just end up at the helm of a new nation. And, you know, legal pluralism is really a structural condition present in, most post-colonial settings. So at some point, many political leaders face this issue, what to do with parallel legal orders that they basically inherited from colonial period. So usually it was a state legal system and customary or traditional law, often also a religious set of laws. And so at some point, very many politicians try to address this issue. And, you know, my thinking about this was that, you know, in many ways, politicians can just ignore that because there are many other important problems. There is not enough political capital to deal with non-state legal systems based on custom and religion. And I think non-interference is actually a default option for many political leaders. And then among kind of more active options, you know, you can either imagine an attempt to eradicate non-state legal system, to centralize law and create a monopoly, like a really a legal monopoly of the state legal order. It can be achieved in different ways, but, you know, quite often we actually saw attempts to eradicate non-state legal systems, to centralize legal orders. And I'm also outlining the approach based on promotion of non-state legal systems. It can be a formal form of promotion, like, you know, putting them in the constitution, providing some kind of institutional guarantees for customary law, for religious law, or it can be informal means of, you know, political support. So I'm especially interested in this strategy of promotion because for me, this was kind of the strategy that I was trying to make sense of in the case of Chechnya. And in trying to understand why do some political leaders try to eradicate legal orders, others promote them, and most, I believe, do nothing, I outlined several important factors. I think the most kind of straightforward one is the issue of state capacity, that especially for understanding why politicians do not interfere with non-state legal systems. You know, many of them just don't have resources, administrative capacity to do that, and it's better to leave things as they are. Thinking about the radical attempts to eradicate non-state legal orders, we can observe the very important role of ideology, especially, you know, Marxist ideology, socialist ideology that motivated many leaders in post-colonial nations to try to centralize law, to get rid of kind of rudiments of the past, the vestiges of colonialism. But, you know, ideology can be different, and some ideologies, for example, you know, stress multiculturalism or, you know, try to highlight that, you know, different groups in society might have different ways of resolving disputes. So the ideology, I think, is also a very important factor to consider. And also in many settings, there is a popular demand for non-state legal orders, for, you know, traditional authorities, and this should also be accounted for. So this, I guess, was my way of summarizing the literature. And, you know, my approach was trying to emphasize the use of non-state legal orders, promotion of non-state legal orders as political strategy that allows politicians to gain legitimacy, that allows them to build a coalition and incorporate traditional authorities, religious authorities, and those segments of the population that benefit from legal pluralism. And finally, as a strategy that I call boundary control. So the idea that leaders in autonomous regions, in kind of federal or kind of post-imperial settings, or leaders of the post-colonial nations often try to kind of increase their autonomy from the metropole, and promotion of legal pluralism can help to achieve this goal. So again, summarizing, I outlined three strategies: non-interference, eradication, and promotion. And I outlined several factors like state capacity and past dependence, the role of ideology, the role of political demands, and this strategy of political control that I try to work with.
So then let's apply that to Chechnya. What was the decision undertaken by the leader there? What does legal pluralism like in Chechnya now?
So, yeah, when I write about Chechnya, I do use the language of strategies. I'm not exactly sure how deliberate this is, or this is based on kind of, you know, intuition or a constellation of factors that really led to adoption of this strategy of promotion of non-state legal systems. So I document throughout the book how the current leadership of Chechen Republic, led by Ramzan Kadyrov, a relatively famous politician, has been systematically promoting customary law in Sharia, often at the expense of state law. So this happens at the level of institutions, like creation of Council of Elders, customary institution, promotion of de facto Sharia courts, and the infrastructure of religious arbitration in the Republic, and also in the form of encouragement of specific practices and policies, like promotion of polygamy, special restrictions on female dress code, adoption of strategies like punishment of relatives of the alleged insurgents with justification to reference to custom. So again, this happens both at the level of institutions and the level of practices, and also in terms of rhetoric, because Ramzan Kadyrov himself and his closest associates, for example, openly called for blood revenge against popular anti-government bloggers and justified many of their practices, again, with references to custom and religion. So I think it's pretty clear that the government of the Chechen Republic has been promoting legal pluralism. And I was trying to understand why. And again, my understanding of it, that very much has to do with legitimacy, because basically promotion of legal pluralism allows a political leader to borrow legitimacy from custom and religion. And these sources of power are very important in Chechnya. There's a very strong legitimacy attached to religion and to custom. Promotion of legal pluralism helps with creation of local legitimacy. Second is the strategy of coalition building, and here promotion of legal pluralism helps to incorporate customary and religious authorities, and also the beneficiaries of the legal pluralism in the rulers' coalition. I in particular emphasize the role of rebels turned bureaucrats. So those Chechen men who used to participate in the war, those who used to fight against the Russian state during the very long, decades-long conflict, then many of them switched sides and became part of the, basically, the Russian state by becoming police officers and serving in different government positions. So promotion of non-state legal orders is very much a concession to this important constituency. And finally, I emphasize how promotion of legal pluralism helps the leadership of Chechnya to kind of further increase their autonomy or police the boundary vis-a-vis the Kremlin, because the leaders of Chechnya, of course, appointees of the Kremlin, and their power very much rests on support for the Kremlin, especially monetary support, institutional support, support in terms of coercive power. But at the same time, they, the leaders of Chechnya want to make themselves indispensable to the Kremlin and further increase their autonomy. And promotion of institutions like polygamy, blood revenge, you know, all these institutions and practices that are really unfamiliar to the bureaucrats and politicians in Moscow help to further isolate Chechnya and further increase the autonomy and power of its leaders.
This is a very helpful overview of what's happening with legal pluralism in Chechnya and kind of how the strategic use of it, as you said, this is happening sort of for a reason and serves political ends for the leadership in Chechnya. Which is very helpful, though it is probably also worth highlighting to listeners that what you've done was a masterful summary. The book has loads more detail on all of this. So for anyone wanting to get into that, please do read the whole book. But thank you, Igor, for the summary to help us understand sort of what's happening and why. Can you take, I suppose, as our next step, us into the book a bit more directly, I suppose, a bit more explicitly? I don't usually ask about specific chapters in books, usually the ideas rather than which chapter they're in, but you've done something really interesting with your chapter 2 particularly. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the purpose of this chapter, as well as some of the main points that you make within it.
Yes, thanks for asking about this. I mean, this was, you know, my chapter 2, which I called The Field, and it's basically dedicated to my fieldwork and ethnographic reflections, is indeed quite unusual for my discipline for political science, and I think in social sciences more generally, because usually some of the elements that I put in this chapter, like reflections on the methods and discussion of positionality of the author of basically kind of reflections on my own work, usually, you know, are buried in the appendix. And I decided that, you know, this is very much an important part of the story. So I followed here probably my favorite book in social sciences. It's a book written by sociologist Georgi Derlugian, and it's called Bourdieu's Secret Admirer in the Caucasus. And there, the author starts the book with basically the outline of his fieldwork, which, you know, I largely follow the footsteps, also doing research in the Caucasus, and I've learned a lot from that book. So I decided also to write a special chapter designated to fieldwork, and it served two purposes. One, it presents a reflection on the research, so it includes reflections on the way I conducted my study. I talk about people I live with together. I reflect on, you know, the fact that, you know, I was associated both with American and Russian universities, the fact that, you know, I was a man, and discussion of gender, discussion of issues of religion, ideology, the fact that I did not speak Chechen language, and kind of trying to reflect on the limitations of the study I posed. So this is very much a methodological chapter, but I also use it as an opportunity to kind of situate the study in the context. So I describe legal pluralism and give details of how exactly it functions to give kind of a reader a sense of the social reality. I describe family life, I describe, you know, architecture, kind of all these setups, settings for the study to help the reader to understand kind of where I'm coming from and where the results that I discuss in the book, you know, are coming from in terms of, again, both methods and the social context. For me, this is probably my favorite chapter, but I can see, you know, that, you know, for maybe for some reasons, for some readers, it will be a distraction from kind of more standard narrative of academic books with, you know, an argument and then evidence in support of it. Here, it kind of makes a detour and provides these reflections, which, you know, for me were important, but again, you know, maybe not every reader would find it this, you know, relevant for the story.
Well, I think it's definitely interesting and different. Like, it wasn't expected, which is one of the reasons I'm asking about it. But it works quite well then, I think, going into the kind of results and discussion you go into because of setting that sort of social context. So I personally liked it in the book, and I'm glad that we got to discuss it a little bit so that listeners are aware of this interesting aspect of your work. Considering that then, I'd like to move on further into the book and ask in some ways about another thing that you've done that's somewhat unusual and also I think quite helpful. Quite often we have sort of histories of a particular conflict and then we go and analyze them. And in many cases that is quite useful, indeed necessary. But we do have a decent kind of history of what the Chechen wars were and what the sort of time periods were, what the different stages were. And so you don't kind of just present them and then analyze them. You show or discuss the history of Chechnya and these conflicts and these periods of conflict through the lens of lawfare kind of straight away. So I wonder if you can maybe take us through that. What would our more traditional understanding of the periods of the conflict look like if we viewed them through the lens of lawfare?
Thanks. I think that, you know, I'm not a historian, but, you know, my reading of the historical works on Chechnya, you know, for me, the summary of it would be that, you know, the history of Chechnya is usually written as a history of warfare, that we know about the very long Caucasian War in the 19th century when the Russian Empire was trying to colonize the region and there was a fierce anti-colonial resistance in the region for a very long time. And then we know the tragic history of the forced deportation of the entire Chechen nation perpetrated by Stalin in 1944. We know the tragic history of the post-Soviet wars, the first Chechen war in the mid-1990s, and the second Chechen war that been going on since 1999 in the early 2000s. So again, I think, as you said, there's the history of the region and the violence, the role of violence, has been pretty well documented by academic historians. And, you know, what I was trying to do is to look at kind of different pieces that I found in secondary literature, try to reconstruct the history of Chechnya through these lenses of coexistence of state law, customary law, and Sharia in different periods. And so I retell the story again. I start with the colonization and the Russian colonization in the 19th century and the resistance against it. And I, of course, outline the basic setup with the role of conflicting sides, but I also pay attention to the use of law, Sharia, and customary law, known as adat, in the struggles by different political leaders. And I tell a story, for example, of Imam Shamil, who is a very famous leader of the anti-colonial resistance in the 19th century, who basically built kind of an Islamic theocracy in the mountains of Chechnya and neighboring Dagestan. And, you know, for him, for example, the Sharia law was very much central for this state-building project. And he was fighting as much against the Russian state and Russian law as against customary law and different kind of customary traditional tribal institutions, because for them, they were also impediments in his state building projects. So I try to kind of trace this history over time and show that, you know, different political leaders was trying to pursue different state building strategies on this engagement between different forms of law, which were, again, very much at the core of political projects that leaders pursue.
So I'd like to get into that in more detail. If we look specifically at the sort of pre-First Chechen War period and the First Chechen War, what role did lawfare play at the core of these events?
During the Soviet time, Chechnya was under the Soviet control, the Soviet government, again, driven very much by this radical egalitarian socialist ideology, was trying to eradicate non-state legal orders after the Soviet power was kind of settled and consolidated. In the beginning, actually, they made an interesting coalition with Islamic clerics and trying to phrase themselves as friends of Sharia law, and even they were at some point functioning Soviet Sharia courts in the region. But after, you know, the Soviet authority was consolidated, the Soviet government was trying to eradicate customary law and Sharia, again, as rudiments of the past, as something to, you know, to fight against. Even though in practice, of course, there was recognition that these eradication attempts did not work to the full extent, and the Soviet police, for example, would sometimes refer to elders to solve particularly difficult crime. But again, for a very long period, for 70 years, customary law and Sharia was suppressed. But because of the heavy repression and kind of alienation of the Chechen population from the Soviet institutions, the population managed to preserve, at least to some degree, customary norms, religious norms, and some institutions of dispute resolution. And so after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Chechnya actually witnessed a real process of political revolution. And the new authorities that emerged in Chechnya declared it independent from Russia, and de facto it was independent in many ways. And the new authorities in the beginning, we're trying to build the new state very much based on the Soviet laws and Soviet practices, because they didn't really know other ways. But from the very start, they were kind of political demands and political projects based on the ideas to revitalize customary law or revitalize Sharia law and build a new political order based on the systems. So after the collapse of the Soviet Union, we saw the proliferation of these ideas, and the notions of Sharia law and customary law were brought back to public. So, but the authorities at the time, headed by Johar Dudayev, the first president of independent Chechnya, he was not very much in the beginning enthusiastic about this, because, you know, he was trying to build his authority based on the secular state institutions, so very much kind of continuation of the Soviet law. But then when the first Chechen War started in 1994, very soon there were kind of institutions that were created. The first Sharia court, for example, was created in the mountains of Chechnya by the rebels in 1995. And then in the after-war period, with the leadership changed after Johar Dudayev was killed, these issues became very politicized and really became central in the struggles for political power and for the form of state building that would have taken the region.
Hmm. Now, it's very helpful to understand the kind of twists and turns. And again, going back to that idea that leaders' decisions are made for strategic purposes and for consolidating political power. You did mention, though, at the beginning that the book doesn't just look at the leader side of things, but also sort of more normal, everyday people. And I'm wondering if we can talk about that aspect of the book's findings, specifically the section where you talk about the impact that experience of conflict had on people's preferences for what sorts of legal systems to choose and to seek out. I wonder, given kind of where we're up to with the chronology of the conflicts, you could help us understand how experience of conflict impacted people's preferences, and especially why the Second Chechen War seemed to have more impact on those preferences than the first.
Yes, absolutely. So for me, the studying the individual choices that, you know, regular everyday choices that ordinary people make was very much at the heart of this study. So for me, it was interesting to understand how do people make these decisions, how do they think about it, how do they talk about it. And a big, you know, part of the study was talking to people, conducting interviews with those who are in charge of adjudicating disputes, like judges, prosecutors, lawyers, but also customary and religious authorities, and also people who went through a dispute and tried to understand their motivation. I think the central empirical foundation to answer this question for me was a survey I conducted in Chechnya, which presented respondents with stylized vignettes based on the real cases of disputes, where I asked people kind of what is the appropriate way to solve this dispute. And it showed me that there's quite a lot of variation in terms of people's preferences in different situations, according to different disputes. So I was trying to understand the factors between these legal preferences. And one of the most striking findings from this work was a presence of large gender gap, that I found that women were much more likely to say in a survey that they are prefer Russian state law in different situations than men. And I conducted a survey in a neighboring republic, and I found no similar results. So I conducted this comparison between Chechnya and Ingushetia, and found that in neighboring Ingushetia, which shares very much kind of cultural setup and institutional setup of legal pluralism, we do not observe a similar gender gap. And so for me, this became really one of the central focuses of my analysis. And I subsequently managed to connect the emergence of this gender gap in Chechnya with experiences of conflict, especially the experience of collective violence during the Second Chechen War. So the main argument there is that the collective violence perpetrated by the Russian state led to disruption of social hierarchies and gender hierarchies in particular, which created conditions for women to pursue their interests through state law. And on average, state law, despite the fact that it's, you know, it's an alien imposition, it's corrupt, it's slow, but it does acknowledge gender equality. And for many situations, for many type of disputes, especially in family law and inheritance, it's beneficial for women to rely on this type of form to adjudicate their disputes. So I was able to find the link between experience of collective violence within Chechnya and this gender gap in legal preferences, and also comparison between Chechnya and the neighboring region of Ingushetia, kind of showed a similar pattern. And this gender gap and the phenomenon of women choosing state law became one of the central parts in the story of the book.
Mm. And I'd love for you to tell us more about it. What sort of happens in a situation, say, if we're looking at family law, where a woman goes to state courts and perhaps the other side of the argument doesn't? I mean, what does it look like when when these legal systems clash? And is it usually in family law?
Yeah, so I found that family law is the most contested domain, like really the most politicized and most difficult. I report in the book the words of one of the main religious authorities in Chechnya, who said that for him it's much harder to reconcile two parties in a child custody case than to solve a blood revenge dispute, which involves, you know, the entire family and usually is, you know, where violence is directly involved. Because, you know, these fights are very heated. And in fact, the three alternative legal orders which are present in Chechnya lead to divergent outcomes. So in the case of child custody, for example, the Russian state courts don't have a clear kind of norm there, but in 95% of cases, in case of divorce, children stay with the mother. Chechen customary law, at least its dominant conservative interpretation, stresses that children belong to the paternal clan. So in case of divorce, children always stay with the father, according to, again, the particular interpretation of the customary law. And according to the Shafi tradition of Sharia law, children stay with the mother until 7 years old, and then they should decide themselves with whom to stay. So here, basically, in this type of disputes, the form you choose largely determines the outcomes you get. So again, of course, the actual dispute resolution very much involves coordination and struggle between the parties. So even if, you know, women try to bring a dispute to state court, you know, they might not necessarily you know, the other side, of course, might not cooperate and prefer to resolve disputes according to customary law and Sharia. So your question is very difficult, trying to understand the actual process. And in the book, I try to highlight that even though there are, you know, these three legal systems that I kind of distinguish for analytical purposes, in reality, what exists in Chechnya is very much a legal hybrid. That, you know, de jure only Russian state law exists in Chechnya, and Sharia law and customary law, you know, they're not formally recognized. But informally or semi-formally, basically every region within Chechnya, every municipality, every community has an institution of Sharia arbitration. So qadis, imams in charge of the arbitration, and often they have a formal government position, like a deputy of a mayor or a deputy of the head of regional administration. But in reality, they are kind of informal religious arbitrators for this type of disputes. And customary law is even more complex because there is, you know, even though there are formal institutions like the Council of Elders, they are mostly playing ceremonial role. And quite often these disputes are decided within the family. So the norms of customary law are very powerful, but there is no kind of clear institutional forum for this adjudication. And so when a dispute happens, you know, different sides usually try to settle disputes first in within the family, relying on the family members who have this authority, and they are in charge of dispute resolution largely based on customary law. You know, but given the divergent interests, divergent preferences, often this resolution fails, and often people go to religious arbitration next. But quite often, again, the people might get a decision by a religious authority, but this decision is not binding. So the enforcement power in custom and religion are based on social pressure, and some people might kind of try to avoid the social pressure or disregard the social pressure and still go to state courts. So there's kind of an informal pyramid in many ways. And, you know, the use of state courts is still very much kind of a very radical option. It's a tiny percentage of disputes that end up in state courts. But, you know, if you do bring a case in state court, the other party kind of has to comply because, you know, they might try to sabotage it for a while, but, you know, there is still kind of this bureaucratic inertia. And, you know, a case initiated in state law will have to proceed.
So given that it is, it sounds like kind of often one of the last things tried or is not the first thing tried and is in many ways quite radical, can you speak a bit more about kind of why experiences of collective violence in the Second Chechen War might prompt women more than men to take this step and seek out the state courts?
So the story I'm trying to tell in this part of the book is that the choices between state and non-state legal systems, you know, are driven often by normative and instrumental considerations. So for some people, the choice of a forum is very much like, you know, affirmation of the identity of, you know, a good Chechen or a good Muslim, or it's, you know, kind of almost like a political ideology that we should only rely on Sharia law, we should only rely on customary law. So there's a very strong normative element involved there, but there's also an instrumental element of kind of forum shopping, that you choose a forum based on the expected outcome, like how favorable it is to you. And of course, you know, there's an understanding that, you know, if you go to state court, you are likely to get a different type of decision than if you go to Sharia forum or try to solve the dispute according to adat, to customary law. And what I'm arguing kind of on the theoretical level is that this choice is also very much determined by the effectiveness of social pressure. And effectiveness of social pressure is related to community cohesion, to the presence of powerful authorities, and the experiences of collective violence perpetrated by the Russian state during the Second Chechen War basically destroyed all type of hierarchies in these communities in Chechnya. So it they made communities much less cohesive. Many influential leaders who had authority were killed. It led to migration and displacement. So families again became kind of separated, and as a result, we don't see these strong cohesive communities which are able to enforce the norm of relying on custom and Sharia and not going to state courts. And so as a result, in Chechnya overall, but especially in the communities which were kind of especially victimized by the collective violence during the Second War, women have more opportunities to pursue their rights, their interests in state courts because the pressure is just much less effective. So this is kind of the one channel, the channel related to social structure. A broader channel that affects, I think, the entire society is that war led to transformation of societal roles, cultural roles in Chechnya. Despite the 70 years of the Soviet rule, Chechnya remained a very conservative patriarchal society, but the war really changed the social roles, gender roles in Chechnya, and women became, they started playing very important political and social roles. So they were the ones, for example, who protested against atrocities committed by the Russian army. They were the ones who would try to negotiate the price for their kidnapped relatives. They were the ones who organized political protests against these atrocities. So they start playing political and social roles. And also they learned the kind of the bureaucratic routine of the Russian state because women were the ones staying in lines to get pension or compensation for the destroyed houses. They were, again, the ones that had this communication with the Russian state. And they learned these bureaucratic routines. They kind of start understanding, you know, getting these skills of engaging with the state and state law. So this kind of cultural transformation. There was also important economic transformation that as a result of the long Second Chechen War, there was profound transformation in economic roles and women became the breadwinners in many families while men were unemployed. You know, for a long time, you know, people told me that, you know, there were basically only two jobs for a man in Chechnya. It's either a police officer, which was super risky, or a taxi driver. And, you know, women in the post-war environment start working in schools, in hospitals, in administration, start opening small businesses like cafes, coffee shops, beauty salons. And having money is very important for accessing state law because, you know, you need money for a lawyer, often you need money for bribes. Unfortunately, it's a quite corrupt system. But it's also related to this larger social transformation of social roles, because, you know, when you start, you know, having money, when you became the main breadwinner, of course, it also changed the dynamic and the relationship. And finally, I also emphasize the importance of local NGOs that emerged as a result of war. Many of these NGOs are explicitly focused on the agenda of women's empowerment. They provide important social support, psychological support, and also legal support and legal aid. So they are the kind of institutional facilitators for that allow women to kind of convert their grievances into actual legal cases. And so these NGOs, in my reading of the story, is also very much product of the war and post-war transformation.
And what has the reaction been like from the customary legal system, from the Sharia legal system, from, you know, has it all been, okay, great, you want to go and do this, go ahead?
I mean, the reaction from, there is always kind of a fight for jurisdiction between different legal systems, even if there is kind of, in the case of Chechnya, there is this kind of legal hybrid that they emphasize, but of course, in Chechnya and in any other society characterized by legal pluralism, the authorities in charge of one legal system would always prefer people to rely only on them. So, of course, there was the negative reaction, and there's a strong narrative that, you know, if you go to state court, you're not a real Muslim, you're not a real Chechen, that there's a very strong norm of ostracism related to going to state court, relying on state to solve especially family law domain disputes, because, you know, this is the most contested area, kind of the family law. So it's seen again very much as a taboo of going to state courts related there. And so there is, of course, a negative reaction from the authorities, but also, you know, what I was really emphasizing was a negative reaction from men, because, you know, No one likes to lose a dispute. And in general, there was this profound transformation in the society, transformation of gender roles. And there was a strong backlash against women relying on state law that was manifested in sometimes even direct acts of violence against women, but also kind of proliferation. You know, I document the proliferation of polygamy, proliferation of domestic violence, which are, of course, also the negative repercussions of the long conflict. You know, what I'm trying to document in the book is also the strong negative reaction of some segments of Chechen men for using state law among women.
No, thank you for adding that in. Before I ask you about what you might be working on now that this book is done, is there anything else you'd like to say on this work, either anything we've not covered or anything further about implications?
No, I mean, I'm very thankful for your questions on this book. And, you know, I'm, I don't think it's possible to cover everything because, the book kind of has multiple lines, different characters, different levels of analysis. But I think, the central elements of the story we covered. So I'm very thankful for you, for your questions.
Well, that just leaves me with my final question. The book came out in 2023. Is there anything you're currently working on or looking to work on that you want to give us a little sneak preview of?
Yes, no, I mean, I now moved from the North Caucasus to the South Caucasus. And for the last year and a half, I've been conducting field work in Armenia and Georgia. And there, my focus is also on law and politics, but from a different angle, different perspective. If in the State Building as Lawfare in the Chechnya book, I was focusing on how politicians and ordinary people engage with state and non-state legal systems. In this new project, I'm mostly interested in kind of in the middle level, so not perspectives from above and from below, but perspective from the middle. So in the way of studying the role of legal professionals in legal politics. So I'm looking at judges, prosecutors, but, you know, legal community more generally, including legal academics. And I'm very interested in the reaction of legal field to radical political change. So I'm studying how legal field in Armenia reacted to the 2018 Democratic Revolution and the program of legal reforms formulated there. So I'm interested in the struggles for legal reform. And I'm also looking at this comparatively and comparing it with Georgia, that also had a Democratic Revolution in 2003 that was associated with radical legal reforms and subsequent changes in government and perpetual struggle for legal reforms that have been going on in Georgia for the last 20 years. So what I'm trying to do is trying to understand the politics of lawyers as a community. So I'm trying to highlight lawyers as political actors and understand how internal struggles for domination within this community affect political struggles, struggles for political power.
All right. Well, hopefully that becomes a book because then we can have you back and you can tell us even more about it. But thank you for the sneak preview while you work on it. And of course, in the meantime, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled State Building as Lawfare, Custom, Sharia and State Law in Postwar Chechnya, published by Cambridge University Press. Yegor, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Miranda.